So said I to myself in my heart, come, enjoy. See good, but these vanity came to destroy. I took as insanity laughter's estate, and as for rejoicing, what does it create? Ecclesiastes chapter 2, that was, verses 1 and 2, in the Word Green version of 2020. Well, that's quite a big jump in time. And that's when it was last modified, so. That's it for today's daily scripture. Little children, let's get on with the article now. Let's return to our study. I just realized I haven't had time to prepare the article today, but that's okay. I mean, it's sometimes a lot more interesting for me when I haven't looked at an article for some time to then come back to it. I believe we're on paragraph 3. That's what I thought. If the survivors of the deluge had a use for firewood. Yeah. Well, it's not if the survivors. It's the survivors of the deluge had a use for firewood, as well as wood to build houses. So it is natural that the wood of the ark was used for both of these purposes and recycling. In other words, yeah, we had this amazing boat, this incredible Noah's Ark landed on a mountain in Turkey after the flood engulfed the world, creating many fossils all over the world. And when the flood drained off the continents, it created huge plateaus with giant canyons in between the plateaus, like the Grand Canyon, and all these huge, huge features of land that are best explained using a global flood. Now, after the ark landed on the mountain in Turkey, it's logical to believe, right, that just simple logic, that they had no other wood because all the trees had died, and they were still, they just landed on a mountain, and there was still very much water on the earth, enough that they couldn't go and find forests anywhere. They had no source of wood other than the ark. That would be the logical assumption. So that's why the ark that we see today is just a remnant of what it was. But it was probably a multi-layer vessel. I mean, more than one. It was said to be 30 cubits in height, 30 Egyptian cubits in height. So 30 times 20 inches is, you know, 20 point whatever for the Egyptian cubit. It's about 600 plus inches high, which is, what is it? Well, if 600 inches is 10 feet or something, isn't it? Or 600, let's divide by 12, you get 600 inches. Fifty feet? Really? Yeah, it's something like that. So it could be, it's multi stories, you know, in terms of if you had 10-foot floors, it could be 5 floors in height, if that's correct. 60 divided by 12, right? That's what we're talking about. Or 600 divided by 12, I should say. 600 inches. Well, I forget the exact number for the Egyptian cubit, so just say 600 inches divided by 12, and that's 50 feet high. That was the height of the vessel. And by the way, as pointed out by Mr. Windsor in his discussion of the ark, And the details, he discussed all the details of it. He mentioned that the largest vessel other than the Ark was something like 10 times smaller, and it foundered. It was nowhere near as big. I forget, was it 10 times smaller? What did he say? Anyway, he discusses it in his article. Let's go to his article again. Where's his article? Here? We're getting there. Let's see, these are the drawings. Here it is, yeah. So, right. The largest wooden vessel ever built by modern man was under 350 feet. It's not 10 times smaller, because Noah's Ark was 500 feet, using the modern foot. And even the Great Pyramid, by the way, there's found in it evidence of the exact size of the modern inch. It's proof of the modern inch having existed as long as the time of the Great Pyramid. I remember seeing that somewhere. All these things take a lot of research, you know, but it just is worth noting that we think of the modern foot and inch as being modern, and the foot is certainly a modern thing, it appears, but the inch may be very ancient. But 350 feet compared to 500 feet for the Ark. But to see the size is the volume. When you cube a dimension, it gets much, much bigger. Like if something is twice as big, and then you have a three-dimensional thing, you have to go 2 times 2 times 2 is 8 times in volume bigger. The USS Wyoming was a structural failure. It failed, partly perhaps because it didn't have a moon pool like Noah's Ark. But Noah's Ark had a moon pool. And now maybe I talk about this somewhere in the article. I probably do. But yeah, he says, yeah. What's 137 foot? Oh, yeah, let's do that calculation. 138 feet. This is worth doing, right? Okay, 138 feet. Divided by, or times 12 to get it into inches, and then divided by the number of inches in a cubit, 20.6 or something, I think it is. It's 80. All right, okay. So the beam width of the vessel is actually 80 cubits. So I was wrong about having to average it by dividing by 5. Is that true? But you have to divide maybe the... Oh, look, but the depth is taken as the beam divided by the square of 5. So let's divide by... No. Let's get back. History tape. Let's go back. Edit. Let's divide by... Yeah, let's divide by... too bad our calculators don't have the number 5. 1.618. We'll just say 1.618. It's close enough. Squared. Equals 30. It's between 30 and 31. There it is. So Mr. Windsor has a lot of useful information in his article on creationism.org. The survivors of the deluge we're talking about. That wood that had saved their lives from the cataclysm of the deluge right? That wiped every living thing from off the face of all earth, that's what the deluge was thus used by them and by their offspring. Epiphanius, who died in 403 of the Common Era, wrote that the ark remains existed in his day in the mountains of the Gordians, or the Cordians, or the Kurds. We saw the map of the CIA, of the land where the Kurds lived. Though, in the 12th century, Benjamin of Tudela wrote that the ark had been moved so as to build a mosque. That's curious, because we see the ark still there today. I don't know what he meant by that. Or we don't know, I should say. Epiphanius was the bishop of Salamis, and he added that if one looked closely enough, one could yet, in the 4th century, see the altar that Noah had built in order to worship God. Now, that altar is down on the lower land, some distance away from the ark site, in the village of Eight, or some place where Noah lived, is what we believe, according to where the altar is located, where you can still see it today. And also the house of Noah, it was discovered, and the sarcophagus was nearby to that of Noah's wife. You know, the burial ground where Noah and his wife were buried is right near the house, I believe, also. So it's not near the ark site either. It's near enough, but it's not just a few hundred yards away. I think it's more than a few hundred yards away. But sometime between the 4th century CE and the present day, it appears that the remains of the ark were buried by mud flow, and this is where it got petrified, and so on. But, or maybe, of course, it could have been petrified long before 400 CE, or 300 CE. It could have been petrified, you know, it was there for thousands of years, but it would only be petrified if it was, you know, under a lot of mud. Or something like, or volcanic flow, or something had buried it. Something must have put weight on it. That's what we believe about that, about the petrification. Otherwise, it would rot, right? But the thing is, at some point, I write here. And maybe I'm wrong about the timing, but I'm saying that sometime at least before the present day, the ark was buried by mud flow and perhaps lava. But the thing is, it was still there in the 4th century, according to Epiphanius. Therefore, it must have happened after the 4th century is what I deduce here. It's logical. But somehow the ark was buried, and perhaps the ark had been buried previously and petrified before the days of Epiphanius, and then, and perhaps it resurfaced in his day before it slid down the mountain, or, you know, there could have been a lot of events happening. We don't know all the details, but it did slide down the mountain, evidently, at some point in the mud flow. Yeah, we'll have to talk about that later, about why we think that. Because that's everything is very detailed in terms of why we think certain things happened in a certain way. You know, there are a lot of details, but the remains of the ark was at some point buried, right? And then it resurfaced again. It could have been buried by lava, but based on the still existing mud flow that surrounds the ark, we deduce these things. It's, you know, along with all the other evidence of everything, all the evidence, including the Bible and all that, which is the best evidence of all, of course, the Bible. But the mud surrounds the ark, okay. And also there's lava on the nearby volcanic peak Ararat. We don't know whether there was lava on this mountain, I guess, which is not close enough to Ararat to say that the volcano where the volcanic activity of Ararat would be involved here, but that the arc location itself was known from ancient times and in the Kurdish mountains is witnessed to by Josephus. And Josephus lived, was born just after the crucifixion of Jesus in the first century. Now, all the writers of barbarian histories make mention of this flood, Josephus writes, and of this ark. Even the barbarian historians, he says, among whom is Berosus the Chaldean. For when he is describing the circumstances of the flood, in other words, he's a Babylonian historian, he goes on thus. Josephus writes, quoting Berosus, it is said, there is still some part of this ship in Armenia at the mountain of the Chaldeans. Now we know it's pretty close to Armenia, where it is today, the border as it is today. And he quotes Berosus further, saying, and that some people carry off pieces of the bitumen, or bitumen, which they take away and use chiefly as amulets for the averting of mischiefs. End quote. It is said, Berosus wrote. So they used it, according to Berosus, as quoted by Josephus, to keep them out of trouble. In other words, you would think it would have that effect, just, you know, something that would be a reminder of ancient events, such as that massive cataclysm, would be something to remind you of the power of the Almighty God, wouldn't it? So that's why they used to go there, and that's why they, evidently that's why they went and got little bits of the ark, little pieces. It was called bitumen because that's what happens when you fossilize something. It becomes like coal, right? It's like coal. You put a lot of pressure on the wood. So if the ark had been buried under enough mud, if it had been buried under a lot of mud, it would have been enough to make it into something like coal. But perhaps the word bitumen is not closely enough translated from the original writing of the language of the Babylonians. It's hard to say whether we have the right word there, but it certainly gives the idea of something like fossilized, right? Because coal is a fossilized material, like bitumen. So Berosus wrote in the time period approximately, or circa, 290 to 278 BCE. So the 3rd century BCE, before the Common Era, that is, before the time of the birth of Jesus, which was 6 BCE in our chronology. And Josephus lived from 37 to approximately 100 of the Common Era, which would be, well, the crucifixion of Jesus was 30 CE, so not long after the crucifixion of Jesus and the resurrection of Jesus in 30 CE also. This birth of Josephus occurred, and so he was born in the time after Jesus' death and resurrection and prior to the destruction of the Jewish temple in 70 CE. And it's remarkable that they still knew about this ship, as they call it, the Ark of Noah, because Berosus, when he was writing, he was describing the circumstances of the worldwide flood. That's what he was talking about when he wrote this. So this is it. The ship is still in Armenia, which is not really Armenia today. It's close, though. So they would consider it, perhaps they wouldn't have the same border that we have today, or their estimate of the border might be slightly different. So we have it's very consistent with this whole geography that's described there. It is in the land of the Kurds or the Kurdians still, even now. Now it's in the place that we call, as named by the Turkish authorities, it's called Noah's Ark National Park. You can even see a sign on the road saying Noah's Ark National, or Noah's Ark, and there's an arrow and the sign's showing how to get to Noah's Ark. But there's a national park there now, so it may even say Noah's Ark National Park on the sign. I'm not sure what it says on the sign, the road sign. But there was a sign at one time in the nearby Turkish countryside on the road, you know, that said, there's Noah's Ark with an arrow, so you could find it from the road. So now let's continue our movie, the Kon-Tiki movie from 1950, with Thor Heyerdahl.
After which we struck out straight across the Pacific. Ocean currents accounted for about one-third of our actual speed, and the rest was the gift of the trade wind. An average day out at sea would be spent in an atmosphere of utter peace and freedom. The sea would often be so calm and the wind so stable that we left the steering oar to fend for itself, and the raft to move at our own sweet will. On such occasions we felt that we were truly living in utopia. The steering oar would bob lazily up and down in the smooth wake, with no one to guide it, left to its own devices. There were no roast chickens flying around, but other delicacies presented themselves with no effort on our part, such as succulent flying fish. The cook's first task every morning was to take his frying pan and walk around the deck, picking up all the flying fish that had landed on the Kon-Tiki during the night. They were absolutely delicious. Once a flying fish had landed on the deck, it was helpless, as these creatures cannot fly, merely glide. A flying fish has to thrust itself up from the surface of the water, and is then able to glide for a few hundred yards before falling back into the sea. One fish actually jumped straight into Robbie's sleeping bag one night, not particularly welcome as it had needle-sharp teeth. It was some consolation to discover later on that this particular species had never before been seen by the human eye. Two fish of this kind, gempilus or snake mackerel, landed on board, which just goes to show that one has to voyage on a prehistoric vessel in order to discover new zoological species in the 20th century. Haugland worked at a scale model of our raft using bits of balsa he found on board. When the weather was really fine, journeying across the Pacific on a raft proved to be the best possible way to relax and enjoy life. About once a fortnight, we'd open our bamboo deck in order to check the ropes and sort out some special equipment that we had promised to test for the US military authorities, in particular, a kind of emergency ration which was being developed in laboratory tests, but which had not yet been tried out in the field. We had supplies of nuts, edible roots, fruit and fish in baskets stowed on deck. This special American consignment was stowed between the logs under our bamboo deck. Opening up the deck revealed the simple yet ingenious design of the raft. On top, there are elastic mats made of bamboo reed, and under this, stout bamboo poles lashed together on top of the transverse logs. Ensuring that the special packages stowed down there and awash with seawater remained dry was one of our problems. But Watzinger had covered the cardboard boxes with a thin layer of pliant asphalt, which had been rolled in sand, to prevent it becoming sticky and provide extra durability. Cardboard treated in this way proved an excellent solution to our problem. Opening up the deck reveals the raft's five center boards. The center board was invented by the prehistoric inhabitants of Peru. These are small boards, 2 feet in width and 6 feet long, which are jammed down, more or less at random, in the cracks between the logs and are kept in place with rope. They act as a sort of keel, as well as a rudder, and assist the raft in moving forward and not sideways. Watzinger rips open an asphalt-covered box in order to check its contents. Part of the tests we were carrying out for the U.S. Armed Forces involved two members of the crew abstaining from eating fresh fish, plankton, or any other fresh food we might have on board, and subsisting exclusively on the special diet that was to be tested. They were just as fit and healthy when we reached the journey's end as the other members of the crew, so the diet must have been excellent. Meanwhile, Lorita prefers the contents of the basket on which she likes to perch, coconuts.
Okay. We've done about another 5 minutes there. That should be good for today. I haven't watched this movie for a long time. Maybe I've never seen this movie. We saw the more recent movies of Thor Heyerdahl, where he was sailing from Africa to the West to get to North America on the Ra expeditions. But this Kon-Tiki was, of course, before I was born. This 1950 movie of the earlier expedition of Thor Heyerdahl. But no, he's not the one talking in the movie. It's a professional voiceover, I believe. He's not the actual voice that we're hearing. But that's the remarkable story of Thor Heyerdahl and his crew. On the Kon-Tiki. And it was a raft, as we saw. Just in fact, when we talked about, I think Noah's Ark was a raft, as was mentioned by, let's try and find that again. Here it is, yeah. Mr. Windsor talked about it. He said it was a raft. It was not. Yeah, he talks about these things, yeah. Talks about boats in general too. A barge, he calls it a barge. But the idea, this is why the ark needed these anchor stones that were called drogue, or dragged behind. They were dragged behind the ark. The anchor stones were used, it was a way of keeping the ark more stable in direction, right, as it moved through the water. And the fact that they were suspended, you know, the anchors were not dragging on the ground. The water was deep enough, of course, they wouldn't reach the bottom of the water, but they would be dragged through the water, and that would give them more buoyancy, so that the drogue anchor stones were not, you know, they were very heavy, but they weren't heavy enough to break the rope, because they were in water, always suspended in the water, which greatly reduces the weight, right? Just in the same way that water is much heavier than air, so it reduces the weight of any object that's put in it. That's why we can float in water. We can't float in air. Most of us anyway, right? The birds can fly, but we don't have that ability. But so you see, he called it a barge. And his writing here is so important to this whole discussion. A naval architect in the modern day writing about Noah's Ark, I mean, that's so precious to have his opinions. And they're so detailed. He's got the detailed drawings, right, as we saw, of the hull and everything of Noah's Ark. The moon pool he showed here in the center, this rectangular moon pool that allowed the water to go up, you see, into the ark itself. So up within the ark itself, the waves of the ocean wouldn't break the ark apart, because it could absorb, you know, the waves through the moon pool. And that was a very ingenious, you know, very advanced technological thing to have in something as ancient as this boat, Noah's Ark. And that's why, perhaps very likely why, this other boat that was not even as big as the Ark failed in the modern day, because it was, you know, the steel boats can be pretty big too, I think, because they're, of course, made of steel, but this is a wooden boat, you see. The wooden boat is a different thing entirely in terms of its strength, because wood is not as strong as steel, and not even close. So wood bending, the bending of the wood is what causes the problem with a structure that's very large made of wood, right? And I think I looked this up in a different place, in some other, you can look up the USS Wyoming and how it failed and find out about that by completely separate research. It has nothing to do with Noah's Ark, it's just another boat that failed. But Noah's Ark, of course, we know succeeded, according to everything. All the evidence says that Noah's Ark was a successful implementation of a design, and oh, there's so many interesting aspects to it. The area of the deck was called the, or expressed in a number of units called Iku in the Babylonian records of the Ark, of the story of the Ark, and those records, the word Iku corresponds to our word acre, and I did that calculation also, I believe, in the article that we're going to actually see. Maybe we can find that. Maybe I can see if I can. Acre, right. In paragraph 7, we're going to see that. In the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is a Sumerian. I guess I shouldn't call it Babylonian. But it's in the same part of the world, the same location as Babylon. I believe that's where these... Well, there were always... All of those things happened. The Sumerians and the Babylonians, they happened to be living in the land of Mesopotamia, which is right in the same area. So I called it Babylonian, but it's Sumerian. The Epic of Gilgamesh, that's older than Babylonian, because Babylonian is quite... Perhaps we could still call it Babylonian, but because we know, of course, that the Tower of Babel was built long before the modern or the more recent nation of Babylon, right around 600 BC was the recenter Babylonian Empire. But now we're done for today. It's September 5th, 2024 of the Common Era. And the time is 21:54 hours Eastern Daylight Time, North American Time. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much, and thank you for listening and watching. And in my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie. They're saying bye for now. We've been studying the Ark of Urartu, Chapter 1, Paragraph 3 today.